All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 3. It's been a little while, but we are back on track. This episode is entitled Introduction to Things Before the Internet Was Amazing. And so just to kind of give you an idea and to frame one of the many aspects of how long and painful and tedious things were before the internet was widely available and you had wireless and you can just one click and buy something. I'm going to give you like an anecdotal story of something that I experienced many times about how to go about finding something or purchasing something before the internet was widely available and ubiquitous. So take, for example, if you will, your mind back to a time when you wanted to purchase anything, right? Like a comic book or, for the purposes of this anecdote, an original Nintendo game, Super Nintendo game, or even Nintendo 64 game, right? So you can imagine two different types of games. One game is a really rare game that you want, but it's hard to find. And the other game is a super popular game that everybody has, but you need to find a store that still sells a copy. Because every time they get a copy of this game, like Super Mario Bros. 3 or something like that, or Street Fighter 2 for the Super NES, the stores sell out and they don't have it. So you don't want to go to the store and show up and ask for something and they don't have it. So again, what are you going to do to be able to find this particular item? And again, this is not unique to video games. It goes for everything. You want a part for your car. You want some sort of electrical component or a certain type of shoe or a cleat because you're playing soccer and your soccer team only uses, you know, one type of shin guard or cleat. You need to be able to find that item, and you couldn't go online to do it because the internet, as you know it today, doesn't exist. It's only a handful of web pages, and it doesn't even offer e-commerce. And I want to stress that, you know, I was someone as a, you know, like young kid slash teen, I had to do this multiple times. So there were things that I wanted, and I had to make phone calls to stores and look them up in the phone book and just go through this whole long rigmarole because, again, the internet as we know it today as the ubiquitous internet did not exist. So taking, for example, a game for the Nintendo. So you had the title in mind. The title could be anything that you want. This could be for the Nintendo, the Super Nintendo, even the N64. You want this game. How do you get it? And this is before the internet. So let's walk through each step that you have to take to be able to get this item before the internet is ubiquitous. So as you probably guessed, you can't go online. You can't get this from Amazon. You can't get this from Best Buy online or any sort of store. Okay, that is precluded from doing. Now, if you wanted to, you could try to order this game from the mail. But just FYI, when we're going back before the internet was really a thing, and you wanted to order something from the mail, you had to use what was known as a catalog. And a catalog is basically a big magazine, all these pages that are mailed to you, and it shows all the different games or CDs or tapes or whatever you want to buy or shoes, and you have to fill out all these forms in the back. But if you're a kid, like I am, you had no way to pay for it because you couldn't write the catalog a check because you're a kid. And even if you did have a checking account and you were able to write the catalog a check and send that in the mail, it would take several days for the mail to arrive, several days for the mail to be processed, and then 10 business days to make sure that the check had cleared because it took a really long time. Back in these days, when you wrote somebody a check, they didn't just say, okay, here you go, you know, take the check and we'll cash it. They had to actually physically call or use a wire service to contact the bank that your check was issued from and check to see if you had that money in your account and then debit it. So that's like at least 10 business days. So if you did anything by mail, it was like a month or two long process. It was awful. Okay, and then there were stores, and you knew where the stores were, but the stores didn't have any sort of online or real-time inventory process. So you couldn't, there's no such thing as logging online and seeing whether or not the store had this particular, you know, Legend of Zelda 2, for example, video game. You couldn't do that. So what did you have to do? So step one is you basically got a book of all the stores. It was the yellow pages or the phone book. And then you looked up every store. For example, we're talking about the Legend of Zelda 2, I guess. You looked up every store that sold toys or computer games or video games. And each store that you found, you just started calling them up out of the blue. And there's a couple different ways that you can sort your calls. So if you're like really savvy, you know your geography and things like that, you can kind of gloss through the phone book and pick all the stores that you know are close to you. But again, most people, including myself, if you're a kid, you have no idea what store is what because they're just listing addresses and parts of a city. You may not even live in the city, okay? And so what you'd have to do is use the alphabet and the city to basically find different stores to call and then to see which one of these stores actually had the video game that you were looking for, okay? And that was like a long ordeal. So first you had to get the phone book, you had to open it up, you had to go to the video game section, if there even was a video game section. Most of the time it was a toy store section. And then you had to start looking up toy stores that sold video games and just looking for the nearest city next to you or parts of town via the addresses that were in your city. And once you located a store, you had to call them. There will be future episodes on this, but it could have been a long-distance phone call, so it could cost you as much as like $1 or $2 just to be able to call and reach out to the store. But once you called the store, they had no real-time inventory system, meaning that you couldn't just call them and say, hey, I want to find this item. And then the clerk at the store would type in the item on the computer, and they would say, we have three of these items in the back room and two of them on the shelves, and I will reserve one for you. That did not exist. Only in like the largest stores, and like Best Buy was one of the first stores that finally spread and had that, and CompUSA was another store that had that and offered that as well. But most of like your mom and pop shops, which primarily existed into the 90s and sold like SNES games and NES games and Sega games and PlayStation games, all those stores, they didn't have like this real-time inventory system. So there's no way for them to know what games they had or did not have, aside from the fact that they had to literally go. You call them up, you say, I want this game, I want The Legend of Zelda 2 or Castlevania 4. They would put you on hold, and then they would walk out and roam the aisles of the store and search the aisle to find the exact game that you wanted. And once they found it, they grabbed it in their hand and they walked back and they said, yes, we're selling you this game, or we have this game available. And the funny thing was that a lot of stores would say, yes, we have this game right now, but I don't know if I'm going to have it an hour from now or 2 hours from now. Because if it was a popular game, they didn't hold it for you. You couldn't, you know, because you couldn't give them any sort of payment over the phone or online. They basically say like, hey, we do have this game. We have three copies of it. And it's available now, but I can't tell you if it's going to be available like 15 minutes from now or 2 hours from now or 2 days from now. So if you want it, you got to come in and get it. And there's been times in my life with certain games, I think the last one that this happened to me was a game called Metroid. It was one of the Metroid games for the Super Nintendo. But anyways, I call the store. They say they have like 3-4 copies. I say that's awesome. You know, I get my parents to drive me down to the store. It's only like 45 minutes away. By the time I get to the store, it's completely sold out, right? Because other people are calling all the time and they're saying, do you have this game? And they said, yes, we have this game. And so they tell like 5 or 10 people, yes, they have the game, but they only have 4 copies, right? So the first 4 people get there, get the copy and leave, and nothing is updated in real time. So you don't get a copy and you don't know what happens. You call them and you're in limbo until you're able to drive to the store. And that's not efficient whatsoever, and it's really annoying, you know, especially for your parents, because they're like, oh, drive me to the store, and you know, saved up my allowance, I'm able to buy this game, and then they take 30 minutes out of their way, you know, or out of their day to go one way to buy the, you know, take you to buy the game, and they don't have it. And then they have to drive all the way back, and you look like an idiot in the car just sitting there while your parents are like, man, I can't believe you took him to the store. I don't want to take him here again. You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. So the other thing to think about is we talked about step one. Step one is that you call a store. Now, what happens in step two? Step two is that once you reach a store and once they tell you, the guy goes and searches or the girl goes and searches through each aisle of the store, they find the copy of the game you want. Again, this is not just restricted to games. This happens for everything. You want a charger for your Nintendo. You want a controller. You want a filter for your car. Anything. This is the process that you go through. So you actually get someone who physically is in the store and they find what you want. You look through the phone book, you call them, they search through, they say yes. Now we have a whole other dance that we have to go through. You know why we have to go through this dance? This dance is called, where is your store located? So step two is finding out directions to get to where you want to go. And again, this will blow your mind, but there was no GPS, there was no MapQuest, there was no Google Maps. So you couldn't just say, what's your address, type it into your phone, type it into your computer, and get instant access, the fastest route, all the traffic, everything, what's the quickest way to get there, nothing. None of this existed, and none of this happened, okay? So I just want to emphasize how detailed and long these conversations on the phone took. Because there was no system for, you know, allowing people to know where they were or where they were going or anything like that. So once you located the item that you actually wanted to locate, you then had to have someone explain to you how to get to the actual physical address. And if they said, oh, man, we're the Video Game Emporium, we're located on 12818 San Bernardino Avenue, 92399, or whatever their address is. And that's just an address I made up. But again, they'd say something like that. If someone told you their address, you'd be like, that means absolutely nothing to me. You just gave me a bunch of numbers and streets. Now today, 2017, addresses, that's everything I need. I type it into my phone, I type it into my computer, Google Maps shows me how to get there and what the fastest route is. Okay, but you know, before the internet was ubiquitous, if someone gave you those numbers, it meant nothing. So then you had to physically ask them and have a conversation. And these were painful conversations, by the way. Okay, how do I get there? How do I get to your store? I know that this is the address. I've written that down with a pencil or a pen on a piece of paper, but you're going to need to give me directions. And then you get engaged in these long conversations. And the person on the phone would be like, hey, do you know where the movie theater off of this street is? And you're like, yes, I do know that. Or like, hey, I want you to go down the freeway and you exit this exit where the Walmart is. And then once you get to the Walmart, you keep going down, or the movie theater, you know, or some other like big marquee location. So they kind of like vaguely describe what their general vicinity was, and then keep giving you like hints. And there were, because again, I've spent a lot of time doing this, stores where you take like a page of notes how to get there. So you're sitting there, okay, I get on the freeway and I exit this exit by the Walmart, and then I make a left on this street and then a right on this other street. And then, okay, you go up to Euclid Avenue. After about three blocks, there's an auto shop. Once you hit the auto shop, you're gonna hang a left. You hang a left where the auto shop is. It's gonna be called Rose Avenue. Okay, then you're going to go down three, four blocks. You're going to hit another street with a 7-Eleven. That street's going to be known as Nimitz Avenue. Once you hit Nimitz Avenue, you're going to hang a right. You hang a right for about 3-4 miles. You go all the way down. Then there's going to be an Altadena Dairy or some other shop, right? And once you hit that shop, you go really slow. And about 300 feet later, you make another left on the side street. And side street is going to be called Love Avenue. You turn on Love Avenue, you go down two more blocks, and then you're going to make a right, and you make a right on Mockingbird. And once you make a right on Mockingbird, our store is going to be on the right about three blocks later, right? So you're just furiously writing like all this stuff down. Okay, I make a left, I make a right, I go 300 blocks, this, that, the other, right? And so it's like a long, tedious process. So you're talking about having like a 15, 20, 30-minute conversation. So the first 10 or 15 minutes is all about like, do you have the item I want? Then once you locate the item that you want, the next 10 or 15 minutes is just this long discussion about how I get to this particular location of where your store is. Now, in retrospect, sometimes it's a lot easier than that, right? Because, hey, I'm right next to this megaplex or this giant thing that you know about or this like really famous, like, oh, you know, if you're in California or in any of the western states, you know where that In-N-Out is in Redlands? Okay, we're about one block from that. Okay, so that made it easy. But so many times these places were located in areas that were like one side street after the other side street after another, and you're driving through and just you had to write everything out in paper. You couldn't, and there's no maps or anything like that could be automatically generated. Now, there were some people that had what were known popularly as Thomas Guides, and that's going to be another episode. So there was a company called the Thomas Map Company, and you could actually like break down every city, you know, every street, every house, like every business by using a Thomas guide. But it was, that was also really tedious. So it was better to get directions. And one of the idiosyncrasies of this era was that all these stores would give you these directions. And once you got the directions, the sucky thing was, is that you, if you were smart, you had to repeat them back to the store owner. So they go through this long, convoluted process of telling you, you know, like where they were located and what side streets that you had to take and this and that. And, you know, you got to drive like four blocks down after the McDonald's and then turn left at the Burger King. And then, you know, you'll see a Ferris wheel and that's how you know you're getting close. And so you're like frantically scribbling all this stuff down. And then you have to say like, okay, hey, I just want to confirm the route that I'm going to do to get there. So I'm going to get on this freeway, the 10 freeway. I'm going to head west towards Los Angeles. I'm going to see the amusement park. And then after the amusement park, nope, it's before the amusement park, right? The person would chime in and be like, oh, okay. You know, because you're writing this stuff down and you can't write as fast as they speak. So this is a whole like 20, 30 minute dialogue just to find out how to get to a place. And now you can do that in just like one click. Right, like I want to. Okay, just give me your address, 12818, et cetera, et cetera. And then you say like, okay, can I confirm your address, 12818, et cetera, et cetera. They say yes. I plug it into my phone, and boom, that's it. It's done. But it was just so tedious looking back, and took so much time just to get the instructions on how to locate and drive to a place. And then you didn't even know if they'd have the item because there's no real-time inventory. They would say, yeah, we have four or five copies of the game right now. And if you're going to get there like the next day or the, you know, 2-3 hours from now, you have no idea. So you could go through all this. Imagine a 30-minute phone conversation, and then it ends up being, okay, you drove all this way for nothing. Maybe I know another store. And then the store owner gets out the phone book and points you to, you know, someone else 15 or 20 miles away. And maybe they have the game, maybe they don't. So it was extremely inefficient. So again, I hope that story kind of frames up what it was like before the internet was amazing and one click and ubiquitous and great. And so talking about the early internet, which there'll be future episodes on different developments, you know, one of the big things that I want people to get their mind around is the concept of access. And so the internet really developed into what we know it is to be today from early 90s to early 2000s, right? So you have like maybe 1990, 1991, and you go all the way to the dot-com bubble bursting in 2000, 2001. And those late 90s, like 98, 99, 2000, you had MapQuest. You could really use it to do some cool things. But for a long time, you're talking about early 90s, 1990, 1991, your big issue was access. And access was difficult for a couple of different reasons, right? So you had this really powerful tool, the internet, where individual users can access content and also create their own content and put them on servers and things like that. But you have to remember that up until the early 2000s, computers were not that common in households and also not very affordable. So many people and even many businesses did not even have access to the internet because they didn't have access to a computer. So that means that a whole bunch of people really weren't able to create content, and a whole bunch of people weren't able to search for content or use the content, because the internet was something that was only used by a fraction of people who had computers, and only a fraction of people in the U.S. had computers. So you're talking about a fraction of a fraction. And the other thing is, even if you had a computer and had access to a computer, you would have to make sure that the computer had access to the internet, meaning that you need to get a modem and all this transmitting equipment, things like that. And even if you did, your access was limited by how much data you could transfer, which was not a lot of data. So you could have access to the internet, but not access to transmit a lot of data, because you're doing everything through the phone lines, and that didn't give you enough bandwidth to do anything cool, right? You couldn't search quickly. There wasn't Google or any sort of search engine. You had to choose which search engine you wanted, and they were all pretty bad. And the other thing was that there was no sort of portability. So if you wanted, quote unquote, access to the internet, that was difficult to get. You couldn't get that through your phone or your smartphone, because those didn't exist, or your laptop. There was no wireless communications as we know it in terms of wireless internet at that point. There were no wireless communications like a 3G or 4G or 4G LTE. So even if you had a cell phone, it couldn't browse the internet or access the internet or transmit data. It can only really make calls. If you had a laptop, there was no wireless, so it would basically just be a brick which you would have to plug into a wall socket in order to get any sort of internet access, right? So access was a huge, really limiting problem that ended up solving itself as the 2000s went on, and we'll talk about that more extensively. So wrapping up this quick little episode, you kind of see how things existed before the internet. So let's look at some, just for fun, some really big internet milestones, and we'll talk about all these more in some future episodes. So one of the biggest milestones that occurred was all the way back in 1958. So the Bell Telephone Laboratories actually developed the first telephone modem. And this was important because the Bell Laboratories were the first people to actually get digital computer output to be converted into an analog phone signal and sent across the United States phone network to other different computers, where they were converted back into digital signals. So the digital signal on your computer went to an analog phone signal, traveled across the phone lines, and then got converted back to a digital signal and went into another modem and computer. So that happened in 1979. So that was 59 years ago. This podcast is recorded in 2017. It happened in 1958. So to give you a little bit of perspective, when the modem was invented, the United States was only 48 states. Neither Hawaii nor Alaska were U.S. states at that time. So in 1958, if you were a U.S. high school or eighth grade student and you took geography, you'd only have to memorize 48 states and 48 capitals. Hawaii and Alaska were not states. They'd become states. I believe both of them became states in 1959. 11 years after the modem was invented, the ARPANET was launched. So this was actually the first set of geographically isolated computers that were able to communicate with each other. I believe it initially started with four different computers, one at UCLA in Los Angeles, one at University of Utah, one at University of Santa Barbara, and the last one at Stanford. Each one of these computers weighed 900 pounds, and it was very primitive. So that's 11 years after the invention of the, you know, telephone modem. 1975 hits, so after the 1969 invention of the first very primitive network among four computers, the personal computer, the first really commercial personal computer hits, the Altair 880, that's the first PC, personal computer, sold. And this really established the hobbyist market for the personal computer. And people who purchased this were Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And it was really more of like a hobby at this point. So if you get a chance, I would watch a great movie / documentary called Triumph of the Nerds. I'll try to post a link to this in the comments, but it really goes through the first early days of the personal computer. But the personal computer was instrumental to the internet taking off, because people had to, one, adopt the personal computer, and once the personal computer was adopted, then they had to start using it to create networks and log on to the first internet. And then taking a really big jump, so a lot of different small things happened between the launch of the personal computer and obviously the internet. So personal computer was launched in 1975 with the Altair 880. Obviously then Apple was founded, Microsoft, IBM got into the market, personal computers flourished. But in terms of the internet, the next really big milestone that I'd like to point out was that in 1989, America Online, which you probably, hopefully heard about, most millennials, that actually launched and got off the ground. That was one of the biggest online services that actually brought online services to the people. Now, the reason I said online services was because the World Wide Web, as you know it, didn't exist. That didn't come until late, I think, 1990, early 1991, and it wasn't really picked up by AOL and Prodigy and a whole host of other internet providers that I'll talk about more in a future episode. But basically, 1989, America Online launches, and they're a bulletin board service. And before there was the internet, there were bulletin boards, and I will discuss everything that you want to know about bulletin boards, because I was a big BBS or bulletin board subscriber user back in, I think, 89 and 90. But America Online was hugely popular. I think millions and millions of people ended up subscribing to it. And they eventually, you know, several years after it was founded, adopted usage to the World Wide Web. So 1989, America Online launches. 1990-1991, we have the introduction of the World Wide Web. It was actually developed by a bunch of physicists in Europe, CERN researchers. They developed HTML, HTTP, and actually the first web page that was put on the World Wide Web. So prior to the development of the World Wide Web by these CERN researchers, the quote-unquote internet was really restricted to like defense contractors, private corporations, and various like researchers and academic institutions. The World Wide Web, the WWW, was like the first open, this is all hands can access and upload web pages and things like that. The other thing I want to note, after the 1990-1991, you know, foundation of the World Wide Web, in 1994, Netscape Navigator is released by a company known as Netscape. So, before Netscape, this is incredulous, but you could browse the World Wide Web, but it was awful. Netscape was the first company to introduce things like the back button and bookmarks and a graphical user interface for being able to look at web pages. And really before before Netscape, the web was, it was serviced by like these proprietary providers like AOL, Prodigy, Earthlink, things like that. And they didn't have like a nice slick web browser. The concept of a web browser, like today Google Chrome or Safari or Internet Explorer, it just didn't exist. And Netscape was the first company to come up with something where you could say forward or backwards, or you know, use a nice graphical user interface to browse the web and search for things and add bookmarks and all that sort of thing. So the first version of Netscape Navigator was released in 94. It was really popular, and again, this is really funny because most millennials have probably never heard of Netscape. This program peaked. It was huge. Everyone used it. It was like Apple before Apple, but it was almost completely gone from the market within 4 years, but it experienced like a spectacular rise. So Netscape Navigator came. It was the first graphical web browser that there was. It had a huge IPO in 1995. It was like a multi-billion dollar company. And then Internet Explorer from Microsoft, which still exists today as, you know, Microsoft Edge, came along and really, you know, was installed with every like Windows and Macintosh purchase and put Netscape out of business by like 1998 or 1999. Netscape had really gone down to zero. But that's, again, a topic for another time. So we can fast forward to 2000, 2001. That's when you had the whole dot-com bubble bursting. So this was a pretty big recession that was caused almost exclusively by the internet. So by this time, the internet, people got it. It was the future. It was the next big thing. You know, there weren't smartphones or any sort of those type of applications, but everyone was just investing like massive amounts of money into like these crazy internet startups like Pets.com and Flues, which was like internet money. Just completely ridiculous. And the whole dot-com thing bubble burst in 2001. Most of these companies, which were just terrible ideas because no one understood the internet at this time, they just were pumping money into it, they went out of business, and a lot of them had IPOs and people lost a lot of money in the stock market, and there was a mini recession that happened in 2001. But as you can guess, because you live in this world now, after the dot-com bubble burst, the internet picked back up. At this point in time, the dot-com bubble burst in 2001, and every single day, every single week, every single month, more and more people were getting computers, and they were getting connected with really fast cable connections. So no longer do you have to dial in with a modem. All these families, all these college campuses were getting cheap PCs. The PCs has Ethernet cables and then wireless routers, and everyone was connected to the internet. And data became so cheap to be non-existent, and everyone started using the internet and posting and putting up things, and then Facebook and social media and everything. So once that dot-com bubble burst 2001, you know, then 2002, 2003, 2004, you just have a massive explosion. You get the iPhone in 2007, you get the BlackBerry in 2005, 2006. Everyone's online, everyone's wireless, then you have the 3G, the 4G, and the internet becomes ubiquitous. And that's the state of the world as we know it today. But again, I hope this episode is really successful in framing just, you know, how tedious business was with pricing, with finding items, everything you can possibly think about. I wasted so much time as a kid tracking down stores on a phone book and making phone calls and trying to see who had what type of inventory. So I hope this has been a helpful episode. There's going to be many more episodes. I have a really good video I'm working on right now about how people paid bills before the internet and before printing and before mail and stuff like that. And if you have any questions, you can always hit me up, will@tritonknowledge.com. And I hope you like this podcast, and we'll be back again next week or two with another podcast.